What is consciousness? Can we explain human consciousness without God? Hello and welcome to the God Story Podcast. I'm Brent Siddle, and on this podcast I'm joined once again by my very special guest, philosopher Joshua Farris, a teacher, pastor, editor, author, blogger and podcaster. His specialities are the soul, divine justice, atonement and a whole lot of other things. He's currently the Humboldt Experienced Researcher Fellow at the University of Bochum. He was a previous fellow at the Creation Project, Carl F. H. Henry Centre and the University of London, among other places. He's been a professor and lecturer at numerous universities. And this time, Joshua is here to talk about human consciousness and why we may need God to explain consciousness. Joshua, hi, welcome again.
Hey, good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, look, it's a pleasure. These are always fascinating discussions. And since we spoke last time, you've been busy podcasting on consciousness and panpsychism, of all things. I'm going to come on and ask you, we need to find out what panpsychism is. But can we deal first, please, with an article you co-authored with Alan C. Is it pronounced Suku?
I think it's Cuckoo.
Cuckoo. With Alan C. Cuckoo in Mind Matters in October, which was called Science of Consciousness, The Elephant in the Room. Now, what is consciousness and why is it so important?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, what is consciousness? Can we give a really simple answer or definition of consciousness? I mean, this is something that is it's very difficult to define, but it's something that's so apparent to us, right? As individuals, it's apparent to us as minds. We are in one sense when we're thinking, we're awake in a sense. We're thinking about something. We are experience something, and what it means to be conscious, you might say, is just the fact of our experiencing, or my experiencing the world and you experiencing the world as well. And there's something really deeply mysterious about the nature of consciousness. And so there's something I think about the nature of consciousness that is immediate to the individual or the individual mind in question, the one who's thinking. There's something immediate. There's something intuitive. There's something that we have direct access to, you might say. I have direct access in some way to my thoughts and feelings and experiences in a way that you don't have access to my thoughts, experiences, and feelings. You can infer maybe from my facial expressions or from my body movements or even from what I say. You can make some sense out of what I'm experiencing or what I'm feeling or thinking, but you don't actually experience what I'm experiencing in that moment. You're not experiencing, and you don't have access to what I'm experiencing. So it seems that there's this notion of experience that seems to be in some ways fundamental to any sort of description of consciousness. And the same thing goes for you, or at least I presume it goes for you as well. And so
I wouldn't know.
But hopefully you know.
Yes, well, I hope so, yes.
So there's this aspect of experience and this notion of being directly aware or at least having access to my own thoughts and experiences and feelings and the sort. And there's something about what it is like to experience as a individual or as a subject or as a person. There's something of what it is like to experience that. And it's that feature of the world that I think is so vital and mysterious, but it's also something simultaneously that we do know something about and that we can say something about. And when we begin to explore, go on this journey of exploring what it is that is consciousness, there's something positively mysterious about it that seems to point us in the direction of some other explanation beyond the material or beyond Science itself, the way that most people would sort of think about science, has its limitations, or has its limitations in terms of trying to make sense of or explain what it is that is consciousness. Nonetheless, it's something still that we or I have direct access to. And it's this mystery that I think is really important in contemporary discussions right now, as neuroscience is like thinking about all these fascinating things, and we have AI and chatbots and all these things, and there's all these questions in contemporary society of, well, maybe like Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, maybe these robots or these things that we create can actually be conscious, can become conscious
Yes.
beings.
Yes. Well, they've tried to convince me they're robots and their AI are sentient or conscious, and I'm still firmly unconvinced. You're right.
As you
There's
should
a
be.
yes, absolutely. I mean, I had Derek Sherman on the show, and I asked him, "Can these things are these things sentient? Can they ever be sentient?" And he said, "Well, no, I don't think so. They're machines." But he said, "Oh, I'm open to the possibility, but I think the answer was firmly no." Now, let's come on and deal with some of the current developments, because these are fascinating in themselves. You write in this article, there's a new path in the science of consciousness that promises to be the final theory of consciousness. Now, what is the new path?
Yeah, so there's a little bit of history here that is kind of important for that kind of make bringing context to that statement. So I'll try to keep it really brief. So in the early 1900s, there's been this sort of wave of thinking about well, mental causes or minds themselves at the intersection of philosophy, religion, and science. And there's all these questions swirling around. And in the early 1900s, you have these sort of strict views called like logical behaviorism, that consciousness is just the external outputs of that we can that are actually the manifestations. And that's just all that there is to consciousness, or mental things, or mental activities, or whatever. And then you have these other theories that come after that. That was really prominent, popular. There was logical positivism that proposed that, in particular, this was particularly damning. Can I say damning? Damning to theism, or to theology itself as a discipline, or biblical studies. And that is that, well, the only thing that we can truly know is that which we can verify through some kind of empirical verificationism. And so you have more complicated theories after that, as well, at the intersection of consciousness, that are basically just materialist views of consciousness, that we are, to keep it real simple, crudely simple, we're just material stuff. And all that's all we need to make sense of consciousness. So our neural patterns, you might say that our consciousness are somehow identical to, or made sense of by, our neural patterns, or the neurons firing in our brain, and the complex as it may be. But then you have in the mid-1900s, you have a sort of beginning to doubt that. And people are starting to ask questions, well, what is this thing that we, what is it like to experience? And how does this fit with the material world that we know so much about from science? They don't seem to fit so well. So then you had these other theories, theories that come on the scene. This is where panpsychism and Philip Goff become really important, because really, at the end of the day, they're unsatisfied with the sort of logical behaviorism or materialism. Consciousness is not just the physical manifestation of the brain acting. It's not just the functions of the brain. It's not identical to the brain itself at all, at least not how we normally conceive of the brain. And so this arguably was brought about by Thomas Nagel and his famous thought experiment. What is it like to experience as a bat? Do bats have experiences? And so from that, because he's unsatisfied with the materialism, he's like, well, we need to posit something that is still scientific, doesn't require God, is still secular, in other words, And so this is when panpsychism really came on the scenes. Really, it started to become prominent in the 70s, 80s, and much more in the 90s and recently. And Philip Goff has kind of taken off with it, and he's really popularized it. And now it's getting all sorts of attention.
Yes, I watched the debate between you and Philip Goff. So let's move on to the panpsychism and the second article you've recently published, this one in the Worldview Bulletin, which is called We Still Need God for Consciousness, Despite Reports to the Contrary. And you write about Philip Goff's Galileo's Error, which is the book where he is propounding these views. What's the problem in your view with Goff's arguments? Well, first of all, what is panpsychism? And what in your view is the problem with Philip Goff's arguments, which are fascinating, by the way?
Yes, yeah, they are fascinating. Philip Goff has both a kind of intelligence, but he also has a rhetoric to kind of back it up. He's very rhetorically effective. So, and his book is very good, Galileo's Error. It's very provocative, at least. So in Galileo's Error, he's putting forward this thesis, and this is kind of consistent with what I was just saying. He was saying that, after Galileo, you had this sort of flourishing of science, where science was giving us all sorts of information about the world. And many historians attribute that to Galileo, because Galileo, when he came on the scene, he kind of objectified nature in a way that was quantifiable. Everything's quantifiable. So we can literally kind of put a number to it. And that's how we can kind of discern or detect information that's present in the world. And so Galileo's Error, his overall basic thesis is basically that, that as helpful as that was, because science has been tremendously helpful in helping us focus on certain sets of data out there, it's missing something really vital and important in the world, and that is what he takes to be, he takes very seriously. Well, what it's like, what really matters to us as human beings, what really kind of makes us tick. The experiences in the world, in other words, the experiences themselves that can't be quantified, not in the typical sense of quantification. Quantifying doesn't make sense of everything in the world, he would say, and I agree with him totally. It can't make sense of everything in the world. In fact, there's this whole other part of reality that actually matters to us more. It's the things that we care about in life that really make it interesting and enjoyable. That's the stuff that he says, this sort of objectification of nature, the quantification of nature that we find in Galileo, is an error. And so we need consciousness that is something other than what is often described as physical bits that are quantifiable or give, that we can mathematically trace in nature.
Yes, I think if I remember rightly, he argues even that atoms are conscious, doesn't he? And that the universe is somehow conscious. Am I right? My question then is, how can the universe be conscious? How can atoms be conscious? Are they conscious? And where does their consciousness come from?
Yeah, so there's different views on this, but yeah, I mean, all panpsychists would say that at some level, what we have at the base of, kind of physics. So there's still many times they're borrowing this from kind of the physicalists. Everything is somehow explained by physics. But it's a physics that's kind of been updated, you might say. Updated from what we normally think of as physics and the studying of the atoms that are underneath all of reality. And some would say that atoms really are conscious, or that they are when they come together in some complexity, they will become conscious themselves. Or if you have some sort of collection of atoms that come together in some way, they will become conscious. Or at some level, there just is this something that is neither conscious nor unconscious, but something that is other than the kind of typical way in which we think about the material world and the mental world. He would say that the whole world or the whole universe itself is in some ways conscious. And so at these underlying levels, it's a little unclear if he would actually say atoms are literally conscious or that they can become conscious in some complex arrangement.
Right. I thought I'd heard him say that, but maybe I misunderstood. How does this all sounds a bit like pantheism to me. How does panpsychism differ from pantheism?
Good question. It could be a form of pantheism insofar as this was actually something that I wanted to talk about with Goff even more, even further. And I'm hoping we have another discussion. He's got a new book out called Why? Great
Great
question.
title for a book, yeah.
A great title. It's very simple. So he actually identifies consciousness at the global level with the universe itself. And so it's hard to determine what he means by that, if the universe is conscious in the way that we are conscious, and how he would differentiate between the two. If he means, it's unclear if he means that the universe just is God in the kind of pantheistic sort of Spinoza sense, or if he's saying something else. It's really unclear. He might be saying something that or he might he, there's a couple things that may be going on. He might be affirming something like the pantheism that you're describing. He might be saying something altogether different that it's hard to pin down, or he may leave that question an open question and just say he doesn't know.
Yes, I'm interested in, because you go on to talk in your article about personal qualities. What makes us people? What gives us the personal qualities that we have? For example, I might like Beethoven and chocolate, not necessarily both at the same time, although that can be great fun. But what does Goff argue about personal qualities?
So he would say at some level that our personal qualities are the product of lower level physical processes, biological processes that at some complex level are give rise to us as conscious beings. So he actually takes seriously the fact that we experience and that the experiences that we have of chocolate ice cream or the experiences we have of listening to Beethoven are real experiences. And so he takes that seriously. Now he d takes it as something that he says is only attributable to persons or subjects like you and I that have experiences and thoughts and intentions and just awareness of our own thoughts. We're able to self-reflect and think about our own thoughts and make decisions and think about the world even from a moral perspective, if there is such a thing as morality. But he would say that the subject itself, while it's necessary to make sense of these experiences, we need some kind of subject, personhood. The person is a product of lower level physical processes or biological processes, and that give rise to a conscious being at some complex level of biological evolution. And so that's what he would say about that, something along those lines. But it's
Okay.
not a soul. It's not a soul like on these older ideas. It's not a soul that can exist disembodied. It's literally whatever the matter is, but it's a different kind of matter that we need to conceive of.
It's like having your cake and trying to have your cake and eat it too, I think. But however,
That's right.
what are personal qualities dependent on something?
Well, I think they are. They must be. Their personal qualities must be dependent upon a person, upon a subject. They must be dependent upon something. For example, when I think about my own thoughts, it's not my thoughts that are thinking. My thoughts are had by me. My thoughts are experienced by me. And I can think about my own thoughts and introspect and on the basis of those thoughts, I can make determinations about things. So I can think about like later on today what I'm going to work on next. And I realize that I have some deadlines coming up for some papers, and Well, I need to deliberate and prioritize which one is more important or priority over another, and I can make a decision based upon that, that I should write this paper, or I should send out this application or something like that. And so all of that is dependent upon me as a thinking kind of thing, a thinking and experiencing kind of thing. They don't exist apart from me. These qualities don't exist in the world independent of me. They exist dependent on my thinking, and presumably the same's for you as well.
I would have thought so. Final question. We're just about running out of time. Time rushes by when I'm talking to you. I don't know why. It just goes. There we are. And I'm conscious that the time is gone. So there you are. Maybe the universe is as well. I don't know. But why
That's
then
right.
do I'm trying. I should behave myself. Why then do we still need God, do you think, for consciousness?
Yeah, I think there's two really big reasons why we need God. I think at one level, consciousness itself, as we said, depends upon somebody, a thinking thing, a thinking person. And the fact of the matter is that all the thinking persons that we know, the thinking things that we know, they come into existence. In other words, they're contingent. Philosophers would call them contingent. And contingent things don't explain themselves. Contingent things like you and I, we come into existence at some, I mean, I was born in 1982. Presumably, I came into existence at that time. As a result of the procreative process, my parents. And so I came into being at a time, and I've lived in time. And that all points to the fact that I'm a contingent being. I don't have the resources to explain myself or to explain where I come from. I don't ex have the resources to explain my origins, in other words. I need something beyond myself that would explain me. And I think there's lots of reasons that God is a better explanation for that than any sort of secular, naturalistic explanation that is out there. But furthermore, I think coupled with this, when we think about the origins of the universe, and particularly our finely tuned universe that has conscious beings that are dependent upon these highly sophisticated, specified brains that we have, that in some way, at least functionally, help us to experience the world. When we think about that world, we have to think or raise the question, well, what is it that is explaining the fact that this world or this universe that Philip Goff talks about, what is it about it? Where does it find its explanations? Where does it come from? And this isn't an argument, I don't think, from ignorance. I think the best explanation is that it does come from a theistic being, something that is a person that we are like, which gets at the real heart of what we profess to be true about humanity in the Christian tradition, that we are imago Dei bearers. We bear the very image of God, and we reflect his nature in some important ways and senses. And I think so when we look at the origins of the universe, been around for I mean, roughly speaking, if you take this seriously, the biologists would say, or the cosmologists would say, it's been around about 13.85 or 8 billion years or something like that. Whatever it is, the point is that we have these rigorous scientific evidences that point us to the origins of the universe itself. And the universe doesn't explain its own origins or the fact that it actually comes into existence. And so, something like God, a being that can make choices and discriminate between choices, actually brings the universe into existence. And he provides the explanation, a sufficient explanation for it. And so I think that coupled with this notion of consciousness, that we need some explanation for our own consciousness, is best explained in theism or in the fact of there being something like a God or God himself, as the Christians profess.
Final question just popped into my head. I know I said that one was a final question, but I'm an interviewer, things change. over time.
Right.
We need to probably invite Philip Goff on the show and see if we can have a discussion about the new book, Why I Might Write to Him. But in your view, having debated with Philip, a tremendously intelligent man, would Philip, do you think, in your view, ever conceive of or admit to the existence of a God that might explain his fully conscious universe? Or is that off the table for him, do you think?
No, I actually don't think it's off the table. I think you very well could. I think if he's pressed hard enough on some of these points that we've been talking about, you know, and some of the minutiae, I think eventually he would come around to saying there is a God or something like a God. It's just not the God that is traditionally conceived of in Christianity. He wants a much, what many would consider a weaker God, who doesn't have all power, who doesn't have all knowledge about the future, who can't be the agent, the person responsible for all the evil in the world. He wants a being that, in fact, is incapable of stopping all the evil in the world. And so it's that kind of God, so a kind of finite God or finite deism that I think his view is really, at the end of the day, compatible with.
Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Joshua Farris, once again, thank you so much. The Humboldt Experienced Researcher Fellow at the University of Bochum. Joshua, thank you so much for your time. It's been greatly intriguing. And thanks to our creative team at Liquid Edge, who sponsor this podcast and to take care of things behind the scenes. Joshua, bless you. Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the God Story Podcast. A huge thank you to all our Patreon supporters who help make this podcast happen. For as little as $5 a month, our supporters get early, ad-free access to all our regular episodes, plus bonus episodes that you won't find anywhere else. Be like them. Just click the Patreon link down in the show notes to visit us at patreon.com/godstorypodcast.